When I was teaching this class and at Annandale, I started thinking about the overall message that we can understand through this song, and just the deep spiritual way that we Christians should understand love. And it's different than the world understands love. And I decided that week I would just write down every time we sung a song of love about Jesus, about this particular concept that we were looking at in this book. This is what we sang in a week. And you sing very similar things. This could be from your lips as well. He's my king. All day long of Jesus I am singing. He my song of joy will ever be. All the while he keeps my heart bells ringing, for his love is everything to me. Now that could be right out of the song. It just absolutely could be right out of this song. Streams of love around my soul are flowing, from his heart love's everlasting spring. Take my life and lead me, Lord. Make my life useful to thee. Let the beauty of Jesus be seen in me, all his wonderful passion and purity. We sang, may his spirit divine all my being refine. Praise the Lord who o'er all things so wondrously reigneth. I am resolved to go to my Savior, leaving my sin and strife. He is the true one. He is the just one. He hath the words of life. I will hasten to him, hasten so glad and free. Fair are the meadows, fairer still the woodlands, robed in their blooming garb of spring. But Jesus is fairer, and Jesus is purer, who makes the woeful heart to sing. Fair is the sunshine, and fairer still the moonlight, and all the twinkling starry host, but Jesus shines brighter, and Jesus shines purer than all the angels heaven can boast. My God and I go through the field together. We walk and talk as good friends should and do. We clasp our hands, our voices ring with laughter. This earth will pass away, and with it common trifles, but God and I will go unendingly. It goes on and on, the songs we sang, just in 1 week. This was just in 1 week. In sorrow I wandered, my spirit oppressed, but now I am happy, securely I rest. From morning till evening, glad carols I sing, and this is the reason I walk with my King. Worthy of praise is Christ our Redeemer, worthy of glory and honor and power, worthy of all of our soul's adoration. You are my strength when I am weak. You are the treasure that I seek. You are my all in all. When I fall down, you pick me up. And when I am dry, you fill my cup. You are my all in all. We sing love songs all the time. And that is what this book is about. It is about understanding how we really love in a way that leads us to a dedication and a devotion to a Savior and a God. And I think that's always what God intended for us to understand in his relationship to us. We're going to continue on now. And we're going to start with chapter 7 and verse 1. And we come to the longest and the boldest of sections of compliments in the song. In these verses, the Shulamite is described by a king who understands the body and of a woman. He starts with her feet, moves straight up her body, ending with the features of her face. How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. The curves of your thighs are like jewels, the works of your hands of skillful workmen. Your navel is a rounded goblet. It lacks no blended beverage. Your waist is a heap of wheat set about with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of the gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are like the pools of Heshbon, the pools and the gate of Bath-Rabban. Your nose is like a tower of Lebanon, which looks towards Damascus. Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel, and the hair of your head is like purple. A king is held captive by your tresses. How fair and how pleasant you are, O love, with your delights. This statue of yours is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like clusters I said, I will go up palm tree and take hold of the branches. Let now your breast be like clusters on the vine, and the fragrance of your breath like apples, and the roof of your mouth like the best wine. The wine goes down smoothly for my beloved, moving gently the lips of the sleepers. He was lustful in the content of this part of this passage. He looks at her feet, once perhaps bare or shod with, you know, probably humble attire. And now I feel sure they have nice sandals on, perhaps jeweled in gold. And he admires her feet, her steps. Why not begin at the bottom and move up, after all? For even the bottom is glorious on this girl. Even her feet are wondrous to behold. Her thighs, her strength, the Hebrew word here actually means yarek, which is the whole leg. It's not the whole leg, but this part right here, this fleshy part here on the inner part of your thigh is what that is. And the part that joins to your pelvis, it's here likened to ornaments. The joints and thighs were like jewels. These are thighs that could please a man. This was a man that knew a woman that had this kind of language. Carved and formed with perfection. He says her navel is rounded goblet, is like a rounded goblet. He moves from her form. He seems almost coarse as he begins with her navel, the core in the center of her body, the symbol of an independent life, once wrapping us in life with another. It's a rounded bowl. The adjective here appears only in the Old Testament, here only in the Old Testament. It's a bowl, and it seems to be this round part here, the rounded bowl. Here, it's almost a plea here that perhaps this beautiful belly would never be lacking of health and substance. It's an enticing part of the body for a man. Her waist is encircled. The Hebrew word here implies she's curvaceous. She's like a heap of wheat tied in the middle. She's curvy. Everything about her is beauty of nature. Lilies indicated intimacy, perhaps. He continues with her breast. He looks upon her and he sees a woman that has noble shape. She has curves in all the right places. We understand all of this. This is what he saw in her that he loved and thought was beautiful. He discusses the invincible loyalty of her neck, and that he would not be able to bend or break her. We've discussed her strength. He saw her eyes as the fish pools of Heshon by the gate of Beth-Rabin. He saw her eyes as these gates, these pools by these gates of this popular city. Heshbon was about 20 miles east of the River Jordan, not far from the Dead Sea. It was a town that was actually a Moabite town that actually Moses conquered and converted to a Levite, a city for the Levites when he came through. And it evidently had some glorious pools beside it. It had springs. And those two pools were calm and still, and I would imagine reflected, you know, the skies, and they would have been a welcome sight for travelers and those who were weary. Her nose was like the Tower of Lebanon. Prominent and strong noses have historically been a sign of strength and honor. I like to think about that because I have had a big nose all my life. So that's wonderful to think about, although they're not seen as beautiful in our society. So you have to live at the right place at the right time. I learned that in India. You can be really unattractive and heavy, which I liked, as long as you have lighter skin. So that was, you know, but of course I didn't care about being beautiful in India, but your head is your head crowns you like Mount Carmel, and the hair of your head is like purple, the perfect symbol of something distinguished. Mount Carmel was impressive, magnificent, there by the Mediterranean Sea. He saw her hair as glossy and purple. Darby states it was her tresses that held him captive. He renders the last phrase as the king is fettered by thy ringlets. I like that. He was just amazed by her hair, as the splendid robes of the queen was the color of her hair. Those ringlets, so soft, so filmy, had the power of iron chains to enthrall this king and enslave him. Verse after verse, we see his bold description of the Shulamite. He was not quite through. He moves on in a more lustful way. His passion was more and more inflamed as he swelled point by point from her feet to her form to her features, her desirability, her perfection, her beauty, her aloofness, her grace. He becomes bolder in his language. How fair and how pleasant you are, O love, and your delights are. This statue of yours is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like clusters. He longed to see all her in all of her dignity, delicious loves and delights. In verse 6 is translated, he stands unmasked by his own words. All restraints are gone here. He's a passion-driven man. It seems to be a language of passion, and he's on fire for her. He says, I said I will go up to the palm tree and I will take hold of the branches. Let now your breast be like clusters of the vine and fragrance of your breath like apples, and the roof of your mouth like the best wine. The wine goes down smoothly, my beloved. Moving gently, he longed to seize her. He desired her to accomplish his passionate goal with all of his strength. Here is asserted, I will, I will, I will, I will, he says. Look at this. He's pursuing with all of his force and all of his strength. He had reached a point where desire could no longer be constrained. He had made up his mind that he wanted her. He would have her. He was careless of the consequences, and he was careless of her. But he continues on. There will be more. His senses are aroused. And the roof of her mouth would be like the best wine, wine that goes down smoothly, my beloved, moving gently the lips of the sleepers. He's gone so far in his passion now that he actually saw himself as one who was drunk. That he was like an intoxicated man who could no longer control what it was that he was doing. Such was his desire to ravish this woman and to have her in all of his power in his palace and in his presence. But he didn't have her in his control. Solomon has finished his intense pursuit. And it is something. He's offered this young lady from those vineyards all that the world could possibly offer. There were before her the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. And it was laid out on the table for her. And she surely felt some intimidation by her circumstances and her situation. She surely did. She had to. She's a young woman. I can't imagine that she didn't. The will of the king of her nation, a chosen nation, after all, was laying out. He's laying out his heart's desire, and it has to do with her. And she alone could satisfy him. This young woman. She was a new experience, I would guess, for the king. We were just talking about that. Just the very fact that he had to force all of these powers. I guarantee you, I bet there weren't many of those 140 he had to persuade like this. My guess would be it didn't take all that. And he had to bring out all of the powers and persuasion and persistence that he had in him. Perhaps something to write a song about. King Solomon, our preacher of Ecclesiastes and our teacher and wise counselor in Proverbs, has in this song, with all artistry and all poetic language and all resources of vocabulary and charm and passion, he has spoken of field and flower, of nature, of military superiority, of cities and fortifications, animals small and large, of songbirds and ripe fruits, of song and movement, and everything wonderful and glorious that you can imagine. He has flattered and fawned this young woman with every desire of his heart in every way that he could possibly think of. He has utterly exhausted all of the resources of his intellect for ways to appeal and attract and to persuade and convince this young woman to belong to him. In the verses that are just examined, only once was our young Shulamite woman, the young lady, able to stop this passionate song of praise and lust just long enough to give him the details, small to him, but great to her, of this terrible, terrible predicament they were in. And she had explained that this was a big mistake and she had never intended for herself to be there, and that she was not impressed and she was not interested to begin with from him. From the very beginning, she never wanted this, and she had been swept away because they just happened to see her and they had brought her in and she didn't have anything to do with this. And she will answer his flattery with some amount of firmness, and she will try to explain why he is not the one for her. And I will tell you something. This is hard. You ever have to tell somebody why you're not in love with them? I had a young man ask me, there's a long story that goes with this, but anyway, I was dating somebody, and he went away to boot camp. He was in ROTC, and he went away, and the night before he went away, he told me that he wanted to marry me. Well, I didn't even know that he cared for me that much. I wasn't about to marry him, you know, and so he was a good friend of Russ's, and he had asked Russ to make sure that I was okay while he was away. It's a kind of a bad situation. So, he did. This is really actually a very bad situation. And I was immature. I didn't know how to handle it. I mean, I think about this young woman. You think about this young woman. She was in a terrible situation. She had to answer a king. And he wanted to know why it was that she wasn't choosing him. Well, this young man came back from summer. And anyway, to make a long story short, he, you know, came to me after Russ had talked to him. And he said, you know, he just really wanted to talk to me, and he was telling me all this. And he said, you know, I'll do anything and whatever and blah, blah. And what is about Russ, and what is it about me that you don't? And it's a terrible situation. And, of course, I was immature and I was young and I didn't know what to say to him, and I couldn't think of anything. And, I don't know what it was, you know. And so finally I just looked at him and I said, well, I don't know. And he was just forcing me to tell him something. You know, because he's just right there, and he wasn't going to leave me alone. And so I just said, well, I don't know. I think it's that you like dogs. So I understand this young woman's predicament. She didn't know what to say. And he said, well, Russ likes dogs, too. That's what he said to me. But it's hard. And she was in a terrible situation. And you don't know what to do. And she, in calmness, it seems, quickly and quietly puts... Oh, I've missed all of this. See, I made all these slides. Look at that. I made that slide. That's a good one. Oh, I'm going to have to go to the next one. But she seems to sort of put an end then to his pursuit. And she begins in verse 10 by saying, I am my beloved, and his desire is towards me. She seems to, in quietness and in calmness, just kind of try to put an end to this pursuit. And she just says, you know, all this is really nice, and I appreciate you admiring me, even though it's kind of gross, but whatever. But my problem is that I belong to another person. That's my problem. And you asked me to give you something that I'd already given to a shepherd. And my life has already been pledged long ago to another. And I've promised myself, my body, my soul, my emotions, my complete devotion to this shepherd. He possesses me fully, and he possesses me forever. And it is so simple when we are devoted in love. It was an absolute dilemma for the king. It was a puzzlement of the song. It was just his greatest dilemma. It is a fascination of our lives, this kind of love. There is no answer, no explanation, no analysis that rightly and justly defines love. It is what God has given, and it's what he alone truly, truly understands. But it is wondrous and it is glorious. And I am thankful for it. And I am so grateful that if we hunger and we thirst for this, that we want to know what our truths of life are about, that we want understanding, that we want wisdom, that we want discernment, that we want to understand this, that He will give it to us in a book such as this, that He will make us understand. I am not that old. I'm probably further towards the end of my life than the beginning of my life. But I will tell you that I know even now about maturing love. That to understand love the way a Christian can understand it, and to mature with a true sense of love, is a great, great gift that God has given us. I am positive of it. This young shepherd held her heart, and it was simply no longer hers to give this king or anybody else. And so how would she answer this king? What more could she say about her love? How would she describe him in detail? It was surely not his stature, it was not his hair, not his riches, not his position that demanded her heart. It was that she loved him and that she belonged to him. And that he desired her and she desired him. And she will lay form and fame and fortune and power and sophistication and popularity and pomp and heart and life, her body and her soul, at the feet of the one who tends the sheep. How does the world deal with that? I will tell you, that is what we do. We lay it all. And it is absolutely what each of us has done. And there's no way for anybody who does not love your Jesus to understand how you love him so. And it's so easy to drift into a place where we do not lay things completely at our shepherd's feet. I've just had my children home over the summer, but before they came home, I went down to visit Will and Sarah. And Will was working on trying out for the law review, and he had just taken his exams, and he had lost about 27 pounds, and he was just... And he and I spent the day together. Sarah had to go up to her folks for a shower, and we went up to Disneyland. We just spent the day together, and we had a lot of conversations about this very thing. I tell you what we end up doing. We just drift away from what this young woman understood. We forget who our heart belongs to, that we've already given ourselves away to something, that we are no longer there to give to someone else, that we don't lay it at God's feet and our shepherd's feet. And we must tell our young people, I don't care if you get in the law review. I don't care if you finish law school. I don't care what happens to you. You lay it at your shepherd's feet. And you take whatever it is that is consuming your life and you say, I got to remember who I am and who I'm devoted to and who I love. Because otherwise, I am going to stay in the palace because of the ornaments that are given to me. Because somebody's hung something around my neck. I'm going to forget that I have a beloved in the field looking for me. And that is absolutely the only thing that brings happiness for us. It is the only thing that will bring you happiness. And she knew it. She was certain of it. Loyalty and love that the world and that Solomon could not understand. He held every outward advantage for this sweet young woman. But he didn't hold what the shepherd held, which was the heart of the Shulamite. And he had the power And you know what they did? They made that king look silly and worthless. Come, my beloved, let us go forth to the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early in the vineyards. Let us see if the vine has budded, whether the grape blossoms have opened, the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes give off fragrance, and at our gates are pleasant fruits. All manner new and old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved. You know, she had told Solomon in the verse before, my beloved is devoted to me too. You know, Solomon couldn't say, you know, he doesn't love you as much as I do. He did. He loved her more. And now she tells him she wanted to be with her beloved. She mentions two things here. She wants to be with him, and she wanted to be rescued by him. Come, my beloved, she cried. That is, after all, the cry of all loving hearts who are separated from the object of their affection, isn't it? Come, take me away from all this. Come and take me back to you. I've thought a lot about that as far as this book is concerned, and how we just long to be with our Lord. It'll be a wonderful day when he arrives for all of us. Make no mistakes, he is coming. He's coming. And he will be here. And he'll remove us from this present world. And this is surely the thought that's implied here, that once he arrived, all would be well. Nothing else would matter to her. And the vanity that surrounded her, all around her, would no longer be anything for her. She wanted to flee with him. Secondly, let us rise early and go to the vineyards. Let us see whether the vine has bloomed, abutted, and its blossoms have opened, and whether the pomegranates have bloomed. And there I will give you my love, and the mandrakes have given forth a fragrance. They had places to go, didn't they? Didn't they? This couple had some places to go. They had some things to do. She wanted to go be with him in the fields and in the villages and the vineyards and places that she had been and labored with him and loved with him in the past before her captivity. Before she was waylaid by a king, she had memories of the past and plans for the future. And she wanted to explain these things to Solomon, who could not possibly understand. I want to tell you, Solomon probably had never, for one thing, I know he hadn't been a shepherd. And I doubt he had wandered in the fields too awfully much. And she wanted to tell him about these wonderful things, which, by the way, in Ecclesiastes, he comes to the conclusion that, I'll tell you what makes you happy. I think what makes you happy in the end is you marry this woman and you enjoy her for the rest of your life. Those are Solomon's words. And he says, and I think what makes you happy is you go to work and you toil and you come home, and the next day you get up and you go to work and you toil and you come home, and every day you come home and you come home and you feed your family. And you have children, and they're your heritage, and you enjoy what it is that God's given you because you understand who you are, and because you understand that it's God that's given it to you. And that is absolutely what he comes to the conclusion of. He comes to the conclusion of what this young woman has told him. She says, I'll tell you what I want. I'll tell you what I want. She desired a life of labor and toil, one in which Solomon could not understand, but observes in Ecclesiastes, that they would be together in all of their labors, that they would be contented with the enjoyment of each day, that each just enough to fill with goodness the stomachs of those that belong to them, for a good night's sleep before checking on the vineyards again. That's what she says. A life where both would care for and appropriately serve one another in a relationship that would fulfill them and make them rich, not materially, nor would it provide gossip or interest to anyone else. How boring is that life? You know, they do all these shows. I haven't watched them, Judy, but all these shows about these people's life. I thought about that one. What if they film me? People be falling asleep. They wouldn't be able to sell it. There's just nothing to my life. And that is what Solomon says brings happiness, to understand who you are and what life is really about. That it's not about all this gossip. It's not about turmoil. It's not about something always happening exciting in your life. It is about understanding God, your relationship with Him, and what He has given us to have joy in. It's not necessarily a life, she says here, that provides gossip or interest to any other. It's not necessarily, she doesn't indicate, filled with the finest schools or the richness of a palace. Her happy anticipation of a life she describes here must be a puzzlement to Solomon, for he does not have any way to understand. And she says, I will not arise to be served my breakfast at the best laid table. My omelets will not be made by others in pans of gold. She doesn't say that. She says, I'll rise up early and I'll go to the vineyards. And I will not spend my time trying to occupy my days, for they will be filled with all kinds of things. Yes, they'll be filled with work, 'tis true, but also, she says, the wonders of nature that God has so wondrously given us. They will be filled with love, with giving and receiving of a single devoted shepherd. Stability of walls and gates that are filled with richness and all manners of fruit, sweet and wonderful to partake of. Mentioning the mandrake, the love apples often associated with physical love. She would give her endearments, one translator says, she would give her caresses that she would be united with him in marriage. And with her fruits being offered and given to her beloved, old and new, her feelings flourished. Sustainment and joy would indeed be this young man and this young woman's. In chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, we see, oh, that you were like a brother to me who nursed at my mother's breast. If I found you outdoors, I'd kiss you. No one would despise me either. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother who used to instruct me. I would give you the spiced wine from the juice of my pomegranates. Let his left hand be under my head and my right hand embrace me. It almost seems she's imagining and she's allowing herself, her imagination to soar now to worlds unknown but easily imagined. She wished for that the period of waiting was over, that it was time now to be seen and that they would be able to be known. This affectionate love that they had for one another could be publicly displayed. She could not wait for the time to come. Let me tell you, you live with a bride or a groom for the last 3 weeks before they get married, and you will understand these sentiments. They are ready to get married. I don't know how many times I heard my daughter say, Mom, I don't even care. I just want to be married. Okay, well, we have to care. We have 200 plus people coming, so you're going to have to care today. Sorry. But they don't care. They just want it to be over. I want the time to be here that I can be with this person that I love. I am ready. And she said, I want to quit waiting so that I can give my full, unfettered love to this young man who I adore so much. Remember, he was pretty cute. And she wanted to lavish all of her love upon him without being condemned or criticized by those around him. She wished to shout it publicly, to show it publicly. She wanted everybody to know it. Strict social restrictions surely had kept this couple apart. It would be improper to express publicly in any way, shape, or form a kiss or a hug. So, and that is true with so many cultures even today. I mean, that's true where I've lived in a lot of places I've lived. That would not have been appropriate. However, it would not have been improper for her had she gone up and kissed her brother. That's what she says. She says, I'll tell you what, I just wish you were just like my brother. Then I'd just run up to you and I'd kiss you in front of everybody. And I'd show you how wonderful you are to me. And so she says, I wish these silly people wouldn't care. You ever have your children say to you, well, I don't know what they care, it's none of their business. When they do something, and I would say, you know, you need to think about how you appear, how you look. Well, I don't know. That's not their business anyway. Well, okay. It may not be, but it is the impression they have of you. So, you know, I don't. Mostly my daughter would say those kinds of things to me, you know. Well, it was inappropriate. And it's hard at times to behave ourselves appropriately, isn't it? It's just hard at times. It's hard for me not to say things I want to say sometimes. I have a really smarty head and smarty pants in this head. And it's bad. I do. And sometimes I can't shut her up. And it's sometimes I say things that are inappropriate. And it's not nice. And it's bad. And we have to conduct ourselves in a way that is fit and proper and appropriate. And she knew that. And she is frustrated with it. And she said, I would just wish you were my brother. Because then I just, you know. Well, we live with social restrictions. And so did this young lady. And she had to, as we have to, behave herself. And she was thoughtful of the situation. And she was excited for a time when this would not be so. And she speaks now of private times that they would enjoy, that they would be married, that she'd take him into her home, that they would have liberty with one another. She talks about making him comfortable, that he would have full reign of her love, that she would love him passionately, that they would embrace in an embrace that was reserved for those who were married. This young woman was ready to fully and wholly belong to this young man in marriage, and then she would be free to express what her heart desired so much, and no one would criticize and ridicule her. And then she says, I want you to swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not arouse or awaken love until she pleases. She's utterly and completely turned down this king, and after all the proposals and promises are made, she was not only not interested in Solomon, but her head was gone, gone, gone. She was gone, man. And we see the warning that comes for the last and final time to these women in Jerusalem, not to make her love inappropriate, that it is not something that is not appropriate, that it is not something that God would not intend. Do not make my love to this beloved something that it is not, just because I am not accepting your king. It is appropriate. Once again, through words and action, she scolded and reminded them that she was not driven to an inappropriate place with her beloved, nor was she drawn away, that she would have something wonderful, but that it was not inappropriate. And it's almost time now to draw this song to a close, and in the closing paragraphs of the song, we deal with three sections, really. It's hard to attribute here who's speaking. The observations are very difficult on this remaining part of the song. And there are admittedly some real hard things about grouping these particular verses. But we're going to do the best we can. Who is this coming from the wilderness leaning upon her beloved? Beneath the apple tree I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. And there she was in labor and gave birth. If you look at verses 5 through 7, in verse 5, I believe it can be attributed to male voices. Friends of the shepherd who cheer at last, perhaps in joy of the long-awaited event, that perhaps the day has come of the marriage. We don't know how we got here. We've arrived, let me go back. We've arrived at this place now, and it seems like a sudden shift. But maybe not. It comes after the warning. I'm done. This is not inappropriate. And then we seem to have these male voices, which are excited about this impending marriage. She had liberty and joy, and he and his friends were excited and happy. They were rejoicing because the bride and groom would finally be together. I believe that that is what this is discussing here. Terrific Disney movie. This would be a great Disney movie, by the way. And after this terrible and traumatic separation, they're together at last. And they don't really dwell on the song about the experience or the separation. Of course, you have to remember Solomon's writing this song. In verse 5, they remember that they met where they met. They met with under this apple tree. In 6, they speak of a seal. Set me as a seal upon thy heart. Wear me as a ring upon thy head. Rendered, wear me as a seal close to your heart, a ring upon your hand. Symbols of ownership are being discussed here. We know historically that seals were placed on the symbols of kingdoms, letters and things like that, to seal things, to show that they were ownership, to show who they belonged to, that contracts were binding. Still today, rings are used as messages of ownership and devotion. People wear class rings to tell of the school they went to, of the class that they are part of, and of course ultimately we wear wedding rings as well. a wedding ring under normal circumstances will send a message out to someone. You know, when I'm at work and I'll have my wedding ring on, hopefully single men. Well, I don't know if they'd find me anyway, but, you know, they wouldn't approach me. I don't know. I don't have that problem. I'm thinking it's my ring. So I'm sure it's my ring, but I'm going with that. But they should show that somebody owns you, that you are not approachable because you belong to somebody else. That hand is marriage is another way that this is read. Love is as strong as death. She identifies here, many waters can quench love, nor can the floods drown it. If a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised. In verse 6 she says, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy as cruel as the grave. She addresses the fact that even death cannot overcome love. We know this. The New Testament addresses this. And perhaps it seems that this part of the song was sung quietly. There seems to be some symbols that would have denoted that it would have been sung quietly. Isn't it interesting that the last and worst enemy of death is not as strong as what this young woman understood? Romans 8, 38 and 39, for I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither present nor future, powers, neither height nor depth or anything else in all of creation will separate us from the love of God that is in our Christ Jesus our Lord. Undivided, single-minded, completely devoted love. Love will not be taken by death. This young woman had already observed that. Death, the one thing in our life that we do not control, we cannot influence, we cannot change it, we cannot design it. It is the strongest force, both physically and spiritually, and it will be reckoned with. It will be reckoned with. You will die. I will die. And this Shulamite observes that even death cannot overcome love. We're told that. We know that in other passages in the New Testament, in 1 Corinthians 13. It seems at the end of verse 6 and 7 that the Shulamite speaks of her life-altering experience in the palace. She talks about jealousy. She realizes that jealousy has spurned on this lustful love. We're going to continue on here. This is one of the passages where a lot of people will talk about, if you read things on the song, that perhaps that's why Solomon went on to prove himself with 1,000 women, that he said, okay, you're not going to have me. I'm going to show you. I'm just going to show you. All these other women are interested in me. So he goes out and ends up with 300 and 700 and many, many more. And I don't know whether that's true or not, but he does have a problem dealing some with his emotion. Perhaps one reason why he had this enormous harem was to prove to this young woman, or perhaps it was just more of an exploration that he never did understand. He had 1,000 women, but the Shulamite woman was not one of them. Isn't that something? You know, this is an incredible story. She wasn't one of them. Can you imagine her telling her kids, yeah, King Solomon liked me, yeah. You know, I mean, really, I think about that. You know, can you imagine? She's married to a chef. Mom, why didn't you marry? We could be princes, you know. Yeah, he's kind of sweet on me. Whatever, you know. I mean, the stories this woman could tell. That's something. But it does not seem that the Shulamite and her beloved deal with these thoughts for long. Verse 7, actually, many think, is the main crux of the whole entire song. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If man were to give all of the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly destroyed. I'll tell you what you can't do. You cannot buy love. That's what this verse says. A victory to be experienced together. Nothing Solomon had or that anybody else could give them could change their love. It is what love is all about. It is what brought our Lord from the heavens to the earth. You cannot define love by things. It is what led him to the cross. It is what allowed God to preserve a remnant. It is what made that remnant. The remnant. It's why Mary did not know what she would do when her Savior was gone. It is what makes us serve. It is what makes us behave ourselves. It is what makes us worship. And so in this final part of the song, we are reminded that nothing that was offered by this king, nothing promised, no separation from the one who was adored, no amount of money, no comfort, no tragedies, no floods, no famines. You cannot drown it. You cannot buy it. You cannot kill it. If one possesses true love, it will never be overthrown. It will never be destroyed. It will not be interfered with, even by a king. And in verses 8 and 9, and really 8 through 14, we have a little sister and she has no breast. What shall we do for our little sister in the day that she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build upon her the battlement of silver, and if she is a door, we will endorse her with the boards of cedar. The trials, the temptations seem to be over. They have gone back to a place where they'd first pledged themselves. They have fought the malice and the enemies of jealousy. It seems here that the brothers are spoken about, that they have come to the conclusion that it will be okay, that the maturity is there, that this young woman can be given. It is the third time that the Shulamite brothers have been discussed. We met them in 1:6. We spoke about them again in 2:15, and this is the last time. They seem harsh towards her at first. They are angry with her. They seem to hinder her in her love, taking her from the pastures to the vineyard. And then when explaining to the women of the Shulamite court while she is dark, she tells them also, she defines to them that it is because her brothers have taken her away. The second time we see them, that they ridiculed her. They feel like the shepherd is taking their sister before it is time for her to be taken. And that is discussed. And now they discuss their little sister. Now they seem to respect her. They use a term of endearment for her. They seem to understand that she is now responsible. She is a mature young woman. She will be able now to marry. The days of long estrangement and separation seem to be over. It seems that the maiden, who was once a child, as discussed here by the brothers, is now mature. She's mature enough to marry. They note here her strength of character. In the Carr word study, it's discussed that the language here indicates a firmness of character, that they see a real strength in her at this point, which will be enhanced by strong silver-covered towers or battlement. He notes that if clauses are not contrasted, there is apposition, both images and stress. I'm not going to go into detail on that, but the security of a person is really what it's talking about, that she's stable and strong enough now at this point in her life to be married, and they feel that it is time. They seem to understand the force and the pure power of her purity. Her upright behavior seems to be addressed. The door, most are in agreement, represent the openness of invitation now. They need to fortify the doors with cedar, but they will allow proper access at the time. Her purity is addressed here. She is strong and fortified. She has proven herself. It is time. She says of herself, I am a wall. Our Shulamite now discusses who she is herself by continuing this assessment. I am a wall. My breasts are towers. Then I became in his eyes as one who found peace. Solomon had a vineyard, a Baal-Haman. He leased the vineyard to keepers. Everyone was to bring for it fruit and 1,000 silver coins, but my own vineyard is set before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000, and those who tend the fruit, 200. She discusses now, she proclaims that I am mighty, I am mature, I am ready for this. She says, then was I in his eyes, the beloved's, one who found favor. I have looked upon him, and I have won his heart, she says. What would be their criticism now? There would be no reason now for them not to be able to be married. There is a peace in the relationship now between she and her shepherd. It was right, and it was the right time. It is interesting, this verse 11 and 12. She seems to address Solomon. She says, Solomon had a vineyard of Baal-Haman. He leased the vineyards to the keepers, and every one was to keep for it fruit, 1,000 silver coins. And then it seems that she says to Solomon, my own vineyard is before me. Oh, Solomon, you may have 1,000. And those who tend to it, its fruit, 200. It's difficult, but I'm going to go through to paraphrase what John Phillips' commentary says, a vineyard had Solomon as the owner of abundance. He put out the vineyard to the keepers, and every man was to bring in for the fruit thereof 1,000 silverlings. My own vineyard is before me, and the 1,000 belong to thee, O Solomon, 200 keepers of the fruit thereof. In other words, you can have all the women, all the people, everybody is at your beck and call, who are yours, and they are many and they are great. But I will keep what is mine, my person, myself. And I will not partake in your harem or be one of yours. I have all I need. I have no need of what you have to offer. And after all, I have the right to assign myself to whoever I would like. And that seems to be the discussion here. That Solomon had a vineyard that was quite extraordinary. He had everybody that he wished at his disposal. But she had the right to be who she would have herself be. You who dwell in the gardens, the companions, listen for your voice. Let me hear it. Make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountain spices. All right. Well, we have our closing here to this wonderful song. And it is a wonderful closing. It is a triumphant song for these two. Our beloved now seems to request that she dwell in his permanent residence. That's what this is. You who dwell in the gardens. That is what is implied here. It doesn't specify necessarily a particular garden. But the wording seems to lead to a home, that he wants her to be home with him, a home setting. It seems to be that this day has arrived that they have waited for. She has given Solomon the final explanation of why it is that she prefers to just remain the shepherds. The witnesses, our friends here now, they hear from your very own voice that I am the one, that forever we will be together. You know, there's a reason why we have witnesses at our wedding. It's not just, I mean, we're not the only ones to do that. Everybody does that. You know, there are witnesses at weddings, and there's a lot of reasons for that. But that's what's being discussed here. That not just the two of us understand this commitment we're making to each other, but there are others who are a part of this. That there are witnesses of this. There are people surrounding us who are listening to us pledge ourselves to one another. You know, that's what the shepherd had wanted to hear. He wanted to hear her voice. He wanted her to return to him the way that he felt. I want everybody to know. This young couple was no different. I am in love with you, and I will be yours forever. And that is what a wedding ceremony is about. In the eyes of God and man, that we pledge ourselves to one another. And it is a spectacular day, and their friends seem to be a part of this. That they are happy. It is a wonderful day for both. Let me hear you say what I have waited so long to hear you say. Let me hear your voice, he says. And she replies in the last verse of this wonderful song. She responds immediately, for how could she not? The time has come, her brothers have said so, she has said so. She has given the king the final message. Make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. Make haste appears only here in the song. It appears 65 times in the Old Testament, but however, and it means flight from the enemies in most instances. Here, she calls him to a rapid, abandoned flight to her. To the slopes of the wonderful spices, full and rich for the taking. Come surely, she says, hasten to me like a gazelle, full of life, full of energy, so able to bound even those mountains and the perfumed pinnacles to be with me. mountains of spices being offered, final invitation, continued celebration of love and communion. This happy couple shares. The joys of a physical union, mutual enjoyment, are stamped with God's approval. It is indeed a song of all songs. It is the song of songs. What a wonderful study, ending with the same sentiments that Revelation 22:20 ends with. Even so, come, Lord Jesus. Our anticipation of our bridegroom coming. That is the same sentiments. It is, I believe, an earthly story with a heavenly implication. After all, it is absolutely our human experiences with our families and our friends and the kingdom. It is our ability to reason through the scriptures that allows us the spiritual experiences, thoughts, and understanding that provide the richness and peace in our lives to grow and to be wise and to discern what this life is all about. What love is about. Though the language of the text in the book is complex, the ideas and the message is not. It is very simple. No book in the Bible is better calculated to alert us to how strong and subtle the forces that can pull us away from our God are. It is a story that will allow us to explore our own selves. How deeply do we love? What is our devotion about? What are we willing to do and to give up? Are we, as Solomon, unable at the end of our lives to understand a pure and undefiled love? Do you know there are many, many people that are? There are lots of people who are just exactly like Solomon. They may not have 1,000+ women, but they may have a few marriages and friends who have come and gone in their lives. Just this rotation of people in and out of their lives. They are devoted. They have devoted themselves at times to causes here and there. You know, you've got people, they'll get an urge to be something or make something of this life. And so they'll build homes for Habitat. Or be involved in a cause that may do this or that. But a true understanding of anything beyond themselves really eludes them. You know, people get involved in causes for their own self. They do not fully understand selflessness and devotion to one who asks of them on a daily basis. To one who does not promise to provide the best of all material things. That is not what our shepherd provides for us. You know, that is the evangelical message that scares me so much when I teach these classes with these women who are not Christians. That evangelical message that if they just pray and come to God and that things will just work out in their life. And that is not the promise that is given. We're not promised material securities, but we're not promised those things. It is not a love, a dedication, or devotion that is driven by those things. It does not promise to make us popular or respected or cool. You know, your young people, they may want to be cool. I mean, I never was cool. I think I'm gonna die and not be, but I don't know. Maybe it's ahead of me. But you know, there are young people that strive for that. I'll tell you, Solomon was cool. He was really cool. He had the greatest of all. And he was popular, and he was powerful, and he was famous, and he had all these things that our world searches for. And our devotion is not driven by any of that. They don't understand a love that says, who am I? I mean, here am I. What can I do for you? Let me take care of that. I want to be yours because I love you. I had in my studies, just to finish the class off here, found a remarkable article. There's a lot written by modern day rabbis if you like to delve into much reading. There's several really good Jewish papers still, you know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, you know, of course, you realize they've not accepted Jesus. I know that. It's not that I'm reading. But they have really some neat insight about just, you know, things. I thought it was interesting when reading the Song of Solomon, what they would write about Song of Solomon. This is a really interesting article that I'm going to have to get my glasses for. But it's written, and it was interesting because he had been in Bosnia after the war, and he'd been with these women whose husbands were in combat, and he had been with them quite a bit, and it had been just him and these women. He'd gotten to know them very, very well. And they had studied the Book of Song of Solomon, and after he had gone home, she wrote to him. And I'm going to read an excerpt of this article that it's a wonderful. It's really a neat article. But anyway, has some neat insight. The Song of Songs tells the story of relationship, its yearnings and heartbreaks, as well as its triumphs and pleasures. It shouts the glories of love and whispers its secrets. I move easily from the relationship of a people with their God to the complex web of relationship and my own life. The song sends me on a spiritual path of relationship. In relationship, all my ideals are tested, and I am shown the places of my own fear, immaturity, impatience, pride, and bitterness. Intimate relationship reveals to me where I still need to work and where I need to heal. And it calls forth my greatest courage and love. My absolute best and worst character traits are made clearly visible in the practice of relationship, as well as a vision of what is possible if I were to open to the great love that God has given. As I enter into the Song of Songs, I am tending the garden of two relationships at once, with my beloved partner in life and with my God. These two relationships depend on each other for their strength and stability. Shortly after my husband, Rachmiel, and I fell in love, he said to me, I am so glad that you love God more than you love me. He could feel that my love for God was a deep pool, a resource for which my love flowed. He also knew that having a relationship with God would mean that I wouldn't expect from a human something that only a divine could give. And Rachmiel was right. My marriage to God is the foundation of my life. It keeps me connected, the waters of the garden from which all of my other relationships grow. She goes on to say, as my marriage to Rachmiel grows, I am beginning to see how this human relationship refines my ability to give and receive, purifies my intentions, opens me to hard truths about myself. The fire of this relationship makes me understand more and makes me understand more and makes me more able to stand before God in humility and express my true passion. As I grow in these two relationships, I sometimes get glimpses of the mystery of love itself. Rachmiel and I disappear, and there is only love. God and I disappear, and there is only love. These glimpses appear when I have surrendered myself totally. The path that the Song of Songs shows me is a path of complete embodiment. Thinking about love will not reveal its mysteries. We must enter through the senses, get our feet dirty, express our passionate longings, and breathe in the fragrances that surround us. It is an interesting endeavor to study the book. It is certainly one of love. There is no doubt about that. I hope that you have enjoyed the book. I certainly did when I studied it. I want to see if there's anyone who has any questions or comments at this time. We're right at 3:30. Does anybody have anything that they would like to talk about or ask?